Will you stay with us in Otherhorde a while?
Willingly. I am seeking to learn about your practice of foretelling. And if there's anything I can tell you in return about what I am, where I come from,
whatever you like,
said Faxa with a serene smile.
This is a pleasant thing,
that you should cross the ocean of space and then, at another 1,000 miles and a crossing of the Karga, to your journey to come to us here. I want her to come to Otherhorde because of the fame of its predictions.
You want to watch us foretelling, then, perhaps? Or have you a question of your own?
His clear eyes compelled truth. I don't know, I said.
No, sooth, said he. It doesn't matter. Perhaps if you stay a while, you'll find if you have a question or no question. There are only certain times, you know, when the foretellers are able to meet together. So in any case, you dwell with us some days.
I did, and they were pleasant days. Time was unorganized except for the communal work, field labor, gardening, woodcutting, maintenance, for which transients such as myself were called on by whatever group most needed a hand. Aside from the work, a day might pass without a word spoken. Those I talked with most often were young Goss and Faxa the Weaver, whose extraordinary character, as limpid and unfathomable as a well of very clear water, was a quintessence of the character of the place. In the evenings there might be a gathering in the hearthroom of one or another of the low, tree-surrounded houses. There was conversation, and beer, and there might be music, the vigorous music of Carhide, melodically simple but rhythmically complex, always played extempore. One night two indwellers danced, men so old that their hair had whitened and their limbs were skinny, and the downward folds at the outer eye corners half hid their dark eyes. Their dancing was slow, precise, controlled. It fascinated eye and mind. They began dancing during third hour after dinner. Musicians joined in and dropped out at will, all but the drummer who never stopped his subtle changing beat. The two old dancers were still dancing at sixth hour, midnight, after 5 Terran hours. This was the first time I had seen the phenomenon of dothe, the voluntary controlled use of what we call hysterical strength, and thereafter I was readier to believe tales concerning the old men of the Handara. It was an introverted life, self-sufficient, stagnant, steeped in that singular ignorance prized by the Handarata, and obedient to their rule of inactivity or non-interference. That rule, expressed in the word nusuth, which I have to translate as no matter, is the heart of the cult, and I don't pretend to understand it. But I began to understand Carhide better after a half-month in Otherhorde. Under that nation's politics and parades and passions runs an old darkness, passive, anarchic, silent, the fecund darkness of the Handara. And out of that silence inexplicably rises the foreteller's voice. Young Goss, who enjoyed acting as my guide, told me that my question to the foretellers could concern anything and be phrased as I liked. The more qualified and limited the question, the more exact the answer, he said. Vagueness breeds vagueness. And some questions, of course, are not answerable. What if I ask one of those?
I inquired. This hedging seemed sophisticated but not unfamiliar. But I did not expect his answer. The weaver will refuse it. Unanswerable questions have wrecked foretelling groups.
Wrecked them?
Do you know the story of the Lord of Shorth, who forced the foretellers of Asen Fastness to answer the question, what is the meaning of life? Well, it was a couple of 1,000 years ago. The foretellers stayed in the darkness for 6 days and nights. At the end, all the celibates were catatonic. The zanies were dead. The pervert clubbed the Lord of Shorth to death with a stone. And the weaver, he was a man named Meshe.
The founder of the Yomesh cult?
Yes, said Goss, and laughed, as if the story was very funny. But I didn't know whether the joke was on the Yomeshta or on me. I had decided to ask
a yes or no question which might at least make plain the extent and kind of obscurity or ambiguity in the answer. Faxa confirmed what Goss had said, that the matter of the question could be one of which the foretellers were perfectly ignorant. I could ask if the Hulm crops would be good this year in the northern hemisphere of S, and they would answer, having no previous knowledge even of the existence of a planet called S. This seemed to put the business on the plane of pure chance divination, along with yarrow stalks and flipped coins. No, said Faxa, not at all. Chance was not involved. The whole process was, in fact, precisely the reverse of chance. Then you mind read? No, said Faxa, with his serene and candid smile. You mind read without knowing you're doing it, perhaps. What good would that be? If the asker knew the answer, he wouldn't pay our price for it. I chose a question to which I certainly lacked the answer. Only time could prove the foretelling right or wrong, unless it was, as I expected, one of those admirable professional prophecies applicable to any outcome. It was not a trivial question. I had given up the notion of asking when it would stop raining or some such trifle, when I learned that the undertaking was a hard and dangerous one for the 9 foretellers of Otherhort. The cost was high for the asker. 2 of my rubies went to the coffers of the fastness, but higher for the answerers. And as I got to know Faxa, if it became difficult to believe that he was a professional faker, it became still more difficult to believe that he was an honest, self-deluded faker. His intelligence was as hard, clear, and polished as my rubies. I dared set no trap for him. I asked what I most wanted to know. On another hard, the 18th of the month, the 9 met together in a big building, usually kept locked. One high hall, stone-floored and cold, dimly lighted by a couple of slit windows and a fire in the deep hearth at one end. They sat on the bare stone in a circle, all of them cloaked and hooded, rough still shapes like a circle of dolmens in the faint glow of the fire yards away. Goss and a couple of other young indwellers and a physician from the nearest domain watched in silence from seats by the hearth while I crossed the hall and entered the circle. It was all very informal and very tense. One of the hooded figures looked up as I came amongst them, and I saw a strange face, coarse-featured, heavy, with insolent eyes watching me. Faxa sat cross-legged, not moving, but charged, full of a gathering force that made his light, soft voice crack like an electric bolt. "Ask," he said. I stood within the circle and asked my question. Were this world, Gethan, be a member of the Ecumen of known worlds 5 years from now? Silence. I stood there. I hung in the center of a spiderweb woven of silence.
It is answerable,
the weaver said quietly. There was a relaxation. The hooded stones seemed to soften into movement. The one who had looked so strangely at me began to whisper to his neighbor. I left the circle and joined the watchers by the hearth. 2 of the foretellers remained withdrawn, unspeaking. One of them lifted his left hand from time to time and patted the floor lightly and swiftly 10 or 20 times, then sat motionless again. I had seen neither of them before. They were the Zanies, Goss said. They were insane. Goss called them time dividers, which may mean schizophrenics. Karaitish psychologists, though lacking mind speech, and thus, like blind surgeons, were ingenious with drugs, hypnosis, spot shock, cryonic touch, and various mental therapies. I asked if these 2 psychopaths could not be cured.
Cured? Goss said. Would you cure a singer of his voice?
5 others of the circle were indwellers of Otherhord, adepts in the Handara disciplines of presence, and also, said Goss, so long as they remained foretellers, celibate, taking no mate during their periods of sexual potency. One of these celibates must be in Kemmer during the foretelling. I could pick him out, having learned to notice the subtle physical intensification, a kind of brightness that signalizes the first phase of Kemmer. Beside the Kemmer sat the pervert.
He came up from Sprevi with the physician, Goss told me. Some foretelling groups
artificially aroused perversion in a normal person, injecting female or male hormones during the days before a session. It's better to have a natural one. He's willing to come, likes the notoriety. Goss used the pronoun that designates a male animal, not the pronoun for a human being in the masculine role of Kimmer. He looked a little embarrassed. Car riders discuss sexual matters freely and talk about Kimmer with both reverence and gusto, but they are reticent about discussing perversion. At least, they were with me. Excessive prolongation of the Kimmer period, with permanent hormonal imbalance towards the male or the female, causes what they call perversion. It is not rare. 3 or 4% of adults may be physiological perverts or abnormals, normals by our standard. They are not excluded from society, but they are tolerated with some disdain, as homosexuals are in many bisexual societies. The Karheidish slang for them is half-deads. They are sterile. The pervert of the group, after that first long, strange stare at me, paid no heed to anyone but the one next to him, the Kemmerer, whose increasingly active sexuality would be further roused and finally stimulated into full female sexual capacity by the insistent, exaggerated maleness of the pervert. The pervert kept talking softly, leaning towards the Kemmerer, who answered little and seemed to recoil. None of the others had spoken for a long time now. There was no sound but the whisper of the pervert's voice. Faxa was steadily watching one of the zanies. The pervert laid his hand quickly and softly on the Kemmerer's hand. The Kemmerer avoided the touch hastily, with fear or disgust, and looked across at Faxa as if for help. Faxa did not move. The Kemmerer kept his place and kept still when the pervert touched him again. One of the zanies lifted up his face and laughed a long, false, crooning laugh. Ah-ha-ha-ha! Faxa raised his hand. At once each face in the circle turned to him as if he had gathered up their gazes into a sheaf, a skein. It had been afternoon and raining when we entered the hall. The gray light had soon died out of the slit windows under the eaves. Now whitish strips of light stretched like slanting phantasmal sails, long triangles and oblongs, from wall to floor, over the faces of the nine. Dull scraps and shreds of light from the moon rising over the forest outside. The fire had burned down long since, and there was no light but those strips and slants of dimness creeping across the circle, sketching out a face, a hand, a moveless back. For a while I saw Fax's profile, rigid as pale stone, in a diffuse dust of light. The diagonal of moonlight crept on and came to a black hump, the Kemmerer, head bowed on his knees, hands clenched on the floor, body shaken by a regular tremor repeated by the slutter-pat-pat of the zany's hands on stone in darkness across the circle. They were all connected, all of them, as if they were the suspension points of a spider-web. I felt, whether I wished or not, the connection, the communication that ran wordless, inarticulate, through Faxa, and which Faxa was trying to pattern and control, for he was the center, the weaver. The dim light fragmented and died away, creeping up the eastern wall. The web of force, of tension, of silence, grew. I tried to keep out of contact with the minds of the foretellers. I was made very uneasy by that silent electric tension, by the sense of being drawn in, of becoming a point or figure in the pattern, in the web. But when I set up a barrier, it was worse. I felt cut off and cowered inside my own mind, obsessed by hallucinations of sight and touch, a stew of wild images and notions, abrupt visions and sensations all sexually charged and grotesquely violent, a red and black seething of erotic rage. I was surrounded by great gaping pits with ragged lips, vaginas, wounds, hell mouths. I lost my balance. I was falling. If I could not shut out this chaos, I would fall indeed. I would go mad. And there was no shutting it out. The emphatic and paraverbal forces at work, immensely powerful and confused, rising out of the perversion and frustration of sex, out of an insanity that distorts time, and out of an appalling discipline of total concentration and apprehension of immediate reality, were far beyond my restraint or control. And yet they were controlled. The center was still Faxa. Hours and seconds passed. The moonlight shone on the wrong wall. There was no moonlight, only darkness, and in the center of all darkness, Faxa, the weaver. A woman. A woman dressed in light. The light was silver. The silver was armor, an armored woman with a sword. The light burned sudden and intolerable. The light along her limbs, the fire, and she screamed aloud in terror and pain. Yes, yes, yes! The crooning laugh of the zany began. Ha 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 ha! And rose higher and higher into a wavering yell that went on and on, much longer than any voice could go on yelling, right across time. There was movement in the darkness, scuffling and shuffling, a redistribution of ancient centuries, an evasion of foreshadows. Light, light, said an immense voice in vast syllables once or innumerable times. Light, log on the fire there, some light. It was the physician from Sprevi. He had entered the circle. It was all broken. He was kneeling by the zanies, the frailest ones, the fuse points. Both of them lay huddled up on the floor. The Kemmerer lay with his head on Fax's knees, breathing in gasps, still trembling. Fax's hand, with absent gentleness, stroked his hair. The pervert was off by himself in a corner, sullen and dejected. The session was over. Time passed as usual. The web of power had fallen apart into indignity and weariness. Where was my answer? The riddle of the oracle, the ambiguous utterance of prophecy. I knelt down beside Faxa. He looked at me with his clear eyes. For that instant I saw him as I had seen him in the dark, as a woman armed in light and burning in a fire, crying out, "Yes!" Faxa's soft speaking voice broke the vision. "Are you answered, Asker?"
"I am answered, Weaver."
Indeed I was answered. 5 years from now Gethin would be a member of the Ecumen. Yes, no riddles, no hedging. Even then I was aware of the quality of that answer, not so much a prophecy as an observation. I could not evade my own certainty that the answer was right. It had the imperative clarity of a hunch. We have NAFAL ships and instantaneous transmission and mind speech, but we haven't yet tamed hunch to run in harness. For that trick we must go to Gethin.
"I serve as the filament," Fax said to me a day or two after the foretelling. "The energy builds up and builds up in us, always sent back and back, redoubling the impulse every time, until it breaks through and the light is in me, around me. I am the light." The old man of Arvin Fastness once said that if the weaver could be put in a vacuum at the moment of the answer, he'd go on burning for years. That's what the Yomeshta believe of Meshe, that he saw past and future clear, not for a moment, but all during his life after the question of Shorth. It's hard to believe. I doubt a man could endure it, but no matter. Nusuf, the ubiquitous and ambiguous negative of the Handara. We were strolling side by side, and Faxa looked at me. His face, one of the most beautiful human faces I ever saw, seemed hard and delicate as carved stone.
"In the darkness," he said, "there were 10, not 9. There was a stranger."
"Yes, there was. I had no barrier against you. You are a listener, Faxa, a natural empath, and probably a powerful natural telepath as well. That's why you're the weaver, the one who can keep the tensions and responses of the group running in a self-augmenting pattern until the strain breaks the pattern itself and you reach through for your answer."
He listened with grave interest. It is strange to see the mysteries of my discipline from outside, through your eyes. I've only seen them from within as a disciple.
If you permit, if you wish, Faxa, I should like to communicate with you in mind speech. I was sure now that he was a natural communicant. His consent and a little practice should serve to lower his unwitting barrier.
Once you did that, I would hear what others think?
No more than you do already as an empath. Mind speech is communication, voluntarily sent and received.
Then why not speak aloud?
Well, one can lie speaking.
Not mind speaking?
Not intentionally. Faxa considered a while.
That's a discipline that must arouse the interest of kings, politicians, men of business.
Men of business fought against the use of mind speech when it first was found to be a teachable skill. They outlawed it for decades.
Faxa smiled. And kings?
We have no more kings.
Yes, I see that. Well, I thank you, Henry. But my business is unlearning, not learning. And I'd rather not yet learn an art that would change the world entirely.
By your own foretelling, this world will change, and within 5 years.
And I'll change with it, Henry. But I have no wish to change it. It was raining, the long, fine rain of Guthenian summer. We walked under the Hemon trees, on the slopes above the fastness where there were no paths. Light fell gray among dark branches. Clear water dropped from the scarlet needles. The air was chill yet mild, and full of the sound of rain. Faxa, tell me this. You, Hundarata, have a gift that men on every world have craved. You have it. You can predict the future. And yet you live like the rest of us. It doesn't seem to matter. How should it matter, Genri?
Well, look, for instance, this rivalry between Karhide and Ogorain, this quarrel about the Sinoth Valley. Karhide has lost face badly these last weeks, I gather. Now why didn't King Argaven consult his foretellers, asking which course to take, or which member of the Curami to choose as Prime Minister, or something of that sort?
The questions are hard to ask.
I don't see why. He might simply ask, who'll serve me best as Prime Minister, and leave it at that.
He might. But he doesn't know what serving him best may mean. It might mean the man chosen would surrender the valley to Orgorain, or go into exile, or assassinate the king. It might mean many things he wouldn't expect or accept.
He'd have to make his question very precise.
Yes.
Then there'd be many questions, you see. Even the king must pay the price. You'd charge him high?
Very high, said Faxa, tranquilly. The Hasker pays what he can afford, as you know. Kings have in fact come to the foretellers, but not very often.
What if one of the foretellers is himself a powerful man?
Indwellers of the fastness have no rank or status. I may be sent to Erenrang, to the Curami. Well, if I go, I take back my status and my shadow, but my foretelling's at an end. If I had a question while I served in the Curami, I go to Orgni fastness, there, pay my price, and get my answer. But we in the Handara don't want answers. It's hard to avoid them, but we try to.
Faxa, I don't think I understand.
Well, we come here to the fastnesses, mostly to learn what questions not to ask.
But you're the answerers.
You don't see yet, Henry, why we perfected and practice foretelling?
No. To exhibit the perfect uselessness of knowing the answer to the wrong question. I pondered that a good while, as we walked side by side through the rain, under the dark branches of the forest of Otherhord. Within the white hood, Faxa's face was tired and quiet, its light quenched. Yet he still awed me a little. When he looked at me with his clear, kind, candid eyes, he looked at me out of a tradition 13,000 years old. a way of thought, and way of life so old, so well established, so integral and coherent as to give a human being the unself-consciousness, the authority, the completeness of a wild animal, a great, strange creature who looks straight at you out of his eternal present.
The unknown, said Fax's soft voice in the forest. The unforetold, the unproven. That is what life is based on. Ignorance is the ground of thought. Unproof is the ground of action. If it were proven that there is no God, there would be no religion, no Handara, no Yomesh, no hearth gods, nothing. But also, if it were proven that there is a God, there would be no religion. Tell me, Genri, what is known? What is sure, predictable, inevitable? The one certain thing you know concerning your future and mine.
Then we shall die.
Yes. There's really only one question that can be answered, Genri. And we already know the answer. The only thing that makes life possible is permanent, intolerable uncertainty, not knowing what comes next.
Chapter 6. One Way into Orgorain.
The cook, who was always at the house very early, woke me up. I sleep sound, and he had to shake me and say in my ear, wake up, Lord Estravan, there's a runner come from the king's house. At last I understood him, and, confused by sleep and urgency, got up in haste and went to the door of my room, where the messenger waited. And so I entered stark naked and stupid as a newborn child into my exile. Reading the paper the runner gave me, I said in my mind that I had looked for this, though not so soon. But when I must watch the man nail that damn paper on the door of the house, then I felt as if he might as well be driving the nails into my eyes. And I turned from him and stood blank and bereft, undone with pain, which I had not looked for. That fit passed, I saw to what must be done, and by ninth hour, striking on the gongs, was gone from the palace. There was nothing to keep me long. I took what I could take. As for properties and banked monies, I could not raise cash from them without endangering the men I dealt with, and the better friends they were to me, the worse their danger. I wrote to my old Kemmering, Asha, how he might get the profit of certain valuable things to keep for our son's use, but told him not to try to send me money, for Tai would have the border watched. I could not sign the letter. To call anyone by telephone would be to send them to jail, and I hurried to be gone before some friend should come in innocence to see me and lose his money and his freedom as a reward for his friendship. I set off west through the city. I stopped at a street crossing and thought, why should I not go east, across the mountains and the plains, back to Kermland, a poor man afoot, and so come home to Esther where I was born, that stone house on a bitter mountainside. Why not go home? 3 times or 4 I stopped thus and looked back. Each time I saw among the indifferent street faces one that might be the spy sent to see me out of Erenrang, and each time I thought of the folly of trying to go home. As well kill myself. I was born to live in exile, it appeared, and my one way home was by way of dying, so I went on westward and turned back no more. The 3 days' grace I had would see me, given no mishap, at farthest to Kuseben on the gulf, 85 miles. Most exiles have had a night's warning of the order of their exile, and so a chance to take passage on a ship down the cess before the shipmasters are liable to punishment for giving aid. Such courtesy was not in Tibe's vein. No shipmaster would dare take me now. They all knew me at the port, I having built it for Argaven. No landboat would let me ride, and to the land border from Erenrang is 400 miles. I had no choice but Kuseben afoot. The cook had seen that. I had sent him off at once, but leaving, he had set out all the ready food he could find, done up in a packet, as fuel for my 3 days' run. That kindness saved me, and also saved my courage, for whenever on the road I ate of that fruit and bread, I thought, there's one man thinks me no traitor, for he gave me this. It is hard, I found, to be called traitor. Strange how hard it is, for it's an easy name to call another man. A name that sticks, that fits, that convinces. I was half convinced myself. I came to Kuseben at dusk of the third day, anxious and footsore, for these last years in Aranrang I had gone all to Greece and luxury, and had lost my wind for walking. And there, waiting for me at the gate of the little town, was Asha. 7 years we were Kemmerings, and had two sons. Being of his flesh born, they had his name, Foref Rem-ir Osborth, and were reared in that clan-hearth. 3 years ago he had gone to Orkney Fastness, and he wore now the gold chain of a celibate of the foretellers. We had not seen each other those 3 years, yet seeing his face in the twilight under the arch of stone, I felt the old habit of our love as if it had been broken yesterday, and knew the faithfulness in him that had sent him to share my ruin. And feeling that unavailing bond close on me anew, I was angry, for Asher's love had always forced me to act against my heart. I went on past him. If I must be cruel, no need to hide it, pretending kindness. Theram, he called after me, and followed. I went fast down the steep streets of Kuseben towards the wharves. A south wind was blowing up from the sea, rustling the black trees of the gardens, and through that warm, stormy summer dusk I hastened from him as from a murderer. He caught up with me, for I was too footsore to keep up my pace. He said, "Theram, I'll go with you." I made no answer. 10 years ago, in this month of Tua, we took oath, and 3 years ago you broke it, leaving me, which was a wise choice. I never broke the vow we swore, Theram. True, there was none to break. It was a false vow, a second vow. You know it, you knew it then. The only true vow of faithfulness I ever swore was not spoken, nor could it be spoken. And the man I swore it to is dead, and the promise broken long ago. You owe me nothing, nor I you. Let me go. As I spoke, my anger and bitterness turned from Asha against myself and my own life, which lay behind me like a broken promise. But Asha did not know this, and the tears stood in his eyes. He said, "Will you take this, Theram? I owe you nothing, but I love you well." He held a little packet out to me. "No, I have money, Asha. Let me go. I must go alone." I went on, and he did not follow me. But my brother's shadow followed me. I had done ill to speak of him. I had done ill in all things. I found no luck waiting for me at the harbor. No ship from Orgoraine lay in port that I might board and so be off Carhide's ground by midnight, as I was bound to be. Few men were on the wharves, and those few all hurrying homeward. The one I found to speak to, a fisherman mending the engine of his boat, looked once at me and turned his back, unspeaking. At that I was afraid. The man knew me. He would not have known unwarned. Tybe had sent his hirelings to forestall me and keep me in Carhide till my time ran out. I had been busy with pain and rage, but not with fear till now. I had not thought that the order of exile might be mere pretext for my execution. Once 6th hour struck, I was fair game for Tybe's men, and none could cry murder but only justice done. I sat down on a ballast sack of sand there in the windy glare and darkness of the port. The sea slapped and sucked at the pilings, and fishing boats jogged at their moorings, and out at the end of the long pier burned a lamp. I sat and stared at the light and passed it at darkness over the sea. Some rise to present danger, not I. My gift is forethought. Threatened closely, I grow stupid and sit on a bag of sand
wondering if a man could swim to Orgorin. The ice has been out of Cherasun Gulf for a month or two. One might stay alive a while in the water. It is 150 miles to the Orgota shore. I do not know how to swim. When I looked away from the sea and back up the streets of Kuseben, I found myself looking for Asher in hopes he still was following me. Having come to that, shame pushed me out of stupor, and I was able to think. Bribery or violence was my choice if I dealt with that fisherman still at work in his boat in the inner dock. A faulty engine seemed not worth either. Theft, then. But the engines of fishing craft are locked. To bypass the locked circuit, start the engine, steer the boat out of dock under the pier lamps, and so off to Orgorin, having never run a motorboat, seemed a silly, desperate venture. I had not run a boat but rowed one on Icefoot Lake and Kerm, and there was a rowboat tied up in the outer dock between two launches. No sooner seen than stolen. I ran out the pier under the staring lamps, hopped into the boat, untied the painter, shipped the oars, and rowed out onto the swelling harbor water, where the lights slipped and dazzled on black waves. When I was pretty well away, I stopped rowing to reset the thole of one oar, for it was not working smoothly, and I had, though I hoped to be picked up next day by an Orgota patrolman or fisherman, a good bit of rowing to do. As I bent to the oarlock, a weakness ran all through my body. I thought I would faint, and crouched back in a heap on the thwart. It was the sickness of cowardice overcoming me. But I had not known my cowardice lay so heavy in my belly. I lifted my eyes, and saw two figures on the pier's end, like two jumping black twigs in the distant electric glare across the water. And then I began to think that my paralysis was not an effect of terror, but of a gun at extreme range. I could see that one of them held a foray gun, and had it been past midnight, I suppose he would have fired it and killed me, but the foray gun makes a loud noise, and that would want explaining. So they had used a sonic gun. At stun setting, a sonic gun can locate its resonance field only within 100 feet or so. I do not know its range at lethal setting, but I had not been far out of it, for I was doubled up like a baby with colic. I found it hard to breathe, the weakened field having caught me in the chest. As they would soon have a powered boat out to come finish me off, I could not spend any more time hunched over my oars, gasping. Darkness lay behind my back before the boat, and into darkness I must row. I rowed with weak arms, watching my hands to make sure I kept hold of the oars, for I could not feel my grip. I came thus into rough water and the dark, out on the open gulf. There I had to stop. With each oar stroke, the numbness of my arms increased. My heart kept bad time, and my lungs had forgotten how to get air. I tried to row, but I was not sure my arms were moving. I tried to pull the oars into the boat then, but could not. When the sweep light of a harbor patrol ship picked me out of the night like a snowflake on soot, I could not even turn my eyes away from the glare. They unclenched my hands from the oars, hauled me up out of the boat, and laid me out like a gutted blackfish on the deck of the patrol ship. I felt them look down at me, but could not well understand what they said, except for one, the ship's master, by his tone. He said, "It's not 6th hour yet." And again, answering another, "What affair of mine is that? The king exiled him. I'll follow the king's order, no lesser man's." So against radio commands from Tibe's men ashore, and against the arguments of his mate, who feared retribution, that officer of the Kuseben Patrol took me across the Gulf of Cherasun and set me ashore safe in Sheltport in Orgorin. Whether he did this in Shifgrethor against Tibe's men, who would kill an unarmed man, or in kindness, I do not know. Nusuth, the admirable, is inexplicable. I got up on my feet when the Orgota coast came gray out of the morning fog, and I made my legs move and walked from the ship into the waterfront streets of Shelt. But somewhere there I fell down again. When I woke, I was in the Commensal Hospital of Cherasun Coastal Area 4, 24th Commensality, Senefni. I made sure of this, for it was engraved or embroidered in Orgota script on the headpiece of the bed.
the lampstand by the bed, the metal cup on the bed table, the nurse's hebs, the bed covers, and the bed shirt I wore. A physician came and said to me, "Why did you resist Dothe?" "I was not in Dothe," I said. "I was in a sonic field." "Your symptoms were those of a person who has resisted the relaxation phase of Dothe." He was a domineering old physician, and made me admit at last that I might have used Dothe strength to counter the paralysis while I rode, not clearly knowing that I did so. Then this morning, during the Thangan phase when one must keep still, I had got up and walked, and so near killed myself. When all that was settled to his satisfaction, he told me I could leave in a day or two, and went on to the next bed. Behind him came the inspector. Behind every man in Orgorain comes the inspector.
"Name?"
I did not ask him his. I must learn to live without shadows, as they do in Orgorain, not to take offense, not to offend uselessly. But I did not give him my land name, which is no business of any man in Orgorain.
"Theramharth? That is not an Orgota name. What commensality?"
"Carhide."
"That is not a commensality of Orgorain. Where are your papers of entry and identification?"
Where were my papers? I had been considerably rolled about in the streets of Shelt before someone had me carted off to the hospital, where I had arrived without papers, belongings, coat, shoes, or cash. When I heard this, I let go of anger and laughed. At the pit's bottom is no anger. The inspector was offended by my laughter.
"Do you not understand that you are an indigent and unregistered alien? How do you intend to return to Carhide?"
"By coffin."
"You are not to give inappropriate answers to official questions. If you have no intention to return to your own country, you will be sent to the voluntary farm where there is a place for criminal riffraff, aliens, and unregistered persons. There is no other place for indigents and subversives in Orgorain. You had better declare your intention to return to Carhide within 3 days, or I shall be... I'm proscribed from Carhide."
The physician, who had turned around from the next bed at the sound of my name, drew the inspector aside and muttered at him a while. The inspector got to looking sour as bad beer, and when he came back to me, he said, taking long to say it and grudging me each word,
"Then I assume you will declare your intention to me to enter application for permission to obtain permanent residence in the great commensality of Orgorain, pending your obtaining and retaining useful employment as a digit of a commensality or township?"
I said, "Yes." The joke was gone out of it with that word, permanent. A skull word if there ever was one. After 5 days, I was granted permanent residence, pending my registry as a digit in the township of Mishnori, which I had requested, and was issued temporary papers of identification for the journey to that city. I would have been hungry those 5 days if the old physician had not kept me in the hospital. He liked having a prime minister of Carhide in his ward, and the prime minister was grateful. I worked my way to Mishnori as a landboat loader on a fresh fish caravan from Shelt. A fast, smelly trip, ending in the great markets of South Mishnori, where I soon found work in the ice houses. There is always work in such places in summer, with the loading and packing and storing and shipping of perishable stuff. I handled mostly fish, and lodged in an island by the markets with my fellows from the ice house. Fish Island, they called it. It stank of us. But I liked the job for keeping me most of the day in the refrigerated warehouse. Mishnori, in summer, is a steam bath. The doors of the hills are shut. The river boils. Men sweat. In the month of Okra, there were 10 days and nights when the temperature never went below 60 degrees. And one day the heat rose to 88 degrees. Driven out into that smelting furnace from my cold, fishy refuge at day's end, I would walk a couple of miles to the Kundera embankment, where there are trees and one may see the great river, though not get down to it. There I would roam late and go back at last to Fish Island through the fierce, close night.
In my part of Mishnori, they broke the street lamps to keep their doings in the dark. But the inspector's cars were forever snooping and spotlighting those dark streets, taking from poor men their one privacy, the night. The new alien registry law, enacted in the month of Kus, as a move in the shadow fight with Karhide, invalidated my registration and lost me my job. And I spent a half month waiting in the anterooms of infinite inspectors. My mate at work lent me money and stole fish for my dinner, so that I got re-registered before I starved. But I had heard the lesson. I liked those hard, loyal men, but they lived in a trap there was no getting out of, and I had work to do among people I liked less. I made the calls I had put off for 3 months. Next day I was washing out my shirt in the washhouse in the courtyard of Fish Island, along with several others, all of us naked or half-naked, when, through the steam and stink of grime and fish and the clatter of water, I heard someone call me by my land name. And there was Commensal Yege in the washhouse, looking just as he had looked at the reception of the archipelagan ambassador in the ceremonial hall of the palace in Erenrang 7 months before.
"Come along out of this, Eschavin,"
he said in the high, loud, nasal voice of the Mishnori rich.
"Oh, leave the damned shirt."
"I haven't got another."
"Fish it out of that soup, then, and come on. It's hot in here."
The others stared at him with dour curiosity, knowing him a rich man, but they did not know him for a commensal. I did not like his being there. He should have sent someone after me. Very few Orgota have any feeling for decency. I wanted to get him out of there. The shirt was no good to me wet. So I told a hearthless lad that hung about the courtyard to keep it on his back for me till I returned. My debts and rent were paid and my papers in my hem pocket. Shirtless, I left the island in the markets and went with Yege back among the houses of the powerful. As his secretary, I was again re-registered in the rolls of Ogorain, not as a digit but as a dependent. Names won't do, they must have labels, and say the kind before they can see the thing. But this time their label fit. I was dependent, and soon was brought to curse the purpose that brought me here to eat another man's bread. For they gave me no sign for a month yet that I was any nearer achieving that purpose than I had been at Fish Island. On the rainy evening of the last day of summer, Yege sent for me to his study, where I found him talking with the commensal of the Sekeve district. Obsler, whom I had known when he headed the Orgota Naval Trade Commission in Erenrang. Short and sway-backed, with little triangular eyes and a fat, flat face, he was an odd match with Yege, all delicacy and bone. The frump and the fop, they looked, but they were something more than that. They were two of the 33 who rule Ogorain. Yet again, there was something more than that. Politenesses exchanged, and a dram of Siddish life-water drunk, Obsle sighed and said to me,
"Now tell me why you did what you did in Sassanov, Esraven. For if there was ever a man I thought unable to err in the timing of an act or the weighing of Shifgrethor, that man was you."
Fear outweighed caution in me, commensal.
"Fear of what, the devil? What are you afraid of, Estravin?"
"Of what's happening now. The continuation of the prestige struggle in the Sinoth Valley. The humiliation of Karhide. The anger that rises from humiliation. The use of the anger by the Karhidish government."
"Use? To what end?"
Obsla has no manners. Yege, delicate and prickly, broke in.
"Commensal. Lord Estraven is my guest, and need not suffer questioning. Lord Estraven will answer questions when and as he sees fit, as he ever did," said Opsle, grinning, a needle hidden in a heap of grease. "He knows himself between friends here."
"I take my friends where I find them, commensal, but I no longer look to keep them long."
"I can see that. Yet we can pull a sledge together without being kemmerings, as we say in Eskeve, eh? What the devil, I know what you were exiled for, my dear. For liking Karhide better than its king."
"Rather for liking the king
better than his cousin, perhaps.
"Or for liking Karhide better than Ogorain," said Yege. "Am I wrong, Lord Estreven?"
"No, Commensal."
"You think, then," said Opsle, "that Tybe wants to run Karhide as we run Ogorain? Efficiently?"
"I do. I think that Tybe, using the Sinnoth Valley dispute as a goad, and sharpening it at need, may within a year work a greater change in Karhide than the last 1,000 years have seen. He has a model to work from, the Sarf, and he knows how to play on Argivan's fears. That's easier than trying to arouse Argivan's courage, as I did. If Tybe succeeds, you gentlemen will find you have an enemy worthy of you." Opsler nodded.
"I wave, Chief Grethor," said Yege. "What are you getting at, Estreven?"
"This. Will the great continent hold 2 Ogorains?
Aye, the same thought," said Opsle.
"The same thought. You planted it in my head a long time ago, Estreven, and I never can uproot it. Our shadow grows too long. It will cover Karhide, too. A feud between 2 clans, yes. A foray between 2 towns, yes. A border dispute and a few barn burnings and murders, yes. But a feud between 2 nations? A foray involving 50 million souls? Oh, by Mesha's sweet milk, that's a picture that has set fire to my sleep some nights and made me get up sweating. We are not safe. We are not safe. You know it, Yege. You've said it in your own way many times." "I've voted 13 times now against pressing the Sinnoth Valley dispute, but what good? The Domination faction holds 20 votes ready at command, and every move of Tybe's strengthens the Sarf's control over those 20. He builds a fence across the valley, puts guards along the fence armed with foray guns. Foray guns! I thought they kept them in museums. He feeds the Domination faction a challenge whenever they need one.
And so strengthens Ogorain, but also Karhide. Every response you make to his provocations, every humiliation you inflict upon Karhide, every gain in your prestige will serve to make Karhide stronger, until it is your equal, controlled all from one center as Ogorain is. And in Karhide they don't keep foray guns in museums. The King's Guard carry them." Yege poured out another dram, a round of life water. "Ogota noblemen drink that precious fire brought 5,000 miles over the foggy seas from Sith, as if it were beer." Upsir wiped his mouth and blinked his eyes.
"Well," he said, "all that is much as I thought, and much as I think. And I think we have a sledge to pull together. But I have a question before we get in harness, Estreven. You have my hood down over my eyes entirely. Now tell me, what was all this obscuration, obfuscation, and fiddle-faddle concerning an envoy from the far side of the moon?"
Genli I then had requested permission to enter Ogorain.
"The envoy? He is what he says he is. And that is
an envoy from another world."
"None of your damned shadowy Karhidish metaphors now, Estreven. I wave Chief Grethor. I discard it. Will you answer me?"
"I have done so."
"He is an alien being," Opsla said, "and Yege,
and he has had audience with King Argivan?"
I answered yes to both. They were silent a minute, and then both started to speak at once, neither trying to mask his interest. Yege was for circumambulating, but Opsla went to the point.
"What was he in your plans, then? You staked yourself on him, it seems, and fell. Why?"
"Because Tybe tripped me. I had my eyes on the stars, and didn't watch the mud I walked in."
"You've taken up astronomy, my dear?"
"We'd better all take up astronomy, Opsley."
"Is he a threat to us, this envoy?"
"I think not. He brings from his people offers of communication, trade, treaty, an alliance, nothing else. He came alone, without arms or defense, with nothing but a communicating device, and his ship, which he allowed us to examine completely. He is not to be feared, I think. Yet he brings the end of kingdom and commensalities with him
in his empty hands.
Why?
How shall we deal with strangers except as brothers? How shall Gethen treat with a union of 80 worlds except as a world?
80 worlds?
Said Yege, and laughed uneasily. Obsle stared at me athwart and said,
I'd like to think that you've been too long with the madman in his palace, and had gone mad yourself. Name of Mesha, watch this babble of alliances with the suns and treaties with the moon. How did the fellow come here riding on a comet? Astride a meteor? A ship? What sort of ship floats on air? On void space? Yet you're no madder than you ever were, Estevan, which is to say shrewdly mad, wisely mad. All carriders are insane. Lead on, my lord, I follow. Go on.
I go nowhere, Upsley. Where have I to go? You, however, may get somewhere. If you should follow the envoy a little way, he might show you a way out of the Cynoth Valley, out of the evil course we're caught in.
Very good. I'll take up astronomy in my old age. Where will it lead me?
Towards greatness, if you go more wisely than I went. Gentlemen, I've been with the envoy. I've seen his ship that crossed the void, and I know that he is truly and exactly a messenger from elsewhere than this earth. As to the honesty of his message and the truth of his descriptions of that elsewhere, there is no knowing. One can only judge as one would judge any man. If he were one of us, I should call him an honest man. That you'll judge for yourselves, perhaps. But this is certain. In his presence, lines drawn on the earth make no boundaries and no defense. There is a greater challenger than Carhide at the doors of Ogorain. The men who meet that challenge, who first open the doors of earth, will be the leaders of us all. All, the three continents, all the earth. Our border now is no line between two hills, but the line our planet makes, encircling the sun. To stake Shifgrethor on any lesser chance is a fool's doing now. I had Yege, but Opsle sat sunk in his fat, watching me from his small eyes.
This will take a month's believing, he said. And if it came from anyone's mouth but yours, Esraven, I'd believe it to be pure hoax. A net for our pride woven out of starshine. But I know you're stiff, Nick. Too stiff to stoop to an assumed disgrace in order to fool us. I can't believe you're speaking truth, and yet I know a lie would choke you. Well. Well. Will he speak to us? As it seems he spoke to you?
That is what he seeks. To speak, to be heard. There or here. Tybe will silence him if he tries to be heard again in Carhide. I am afraid for him. He seems not to understand his danger.
Will you tell us what you know?
I will. But is there a reason why he can't come here? And tell you himself? Yege said, biting his fingernail delicately.
I think not. He has requested permission to enter the Commensality. Carhide makes no objection. His request is under consideration.
Chapter 7 The Question of Sex. From Field Notes of Ongtot Opong, Investigator of the First Ecumenical Landing Party on Gethen / Winter, Cycle 93, EY, 1448. 1448, Day 81. It seems likely that they were an experiment. The thought is unpleasant, but now that there is evidence to indicate that the Terran colony was an experiment, the planting of one Hainish normal group on a world with its own proto-hominid autochthonies, the possibility cannot be ignored. Human genetic manipulation was certainly practiced by the colonizers. Nothing else explains the Hilfs of Es, or the degenerate winged hominids of Rokanan. Will anything else explain Gathenian sexual physiology? Accident, possibly. Natural selection, hardly. Their ambisexuality has little or no adaptive value. Why pick so harsh a world for an experiment? No answer. Tinnebossel thinks the colony was introduced during a major interglacial. Conditions may have been fairly mild for their first 40 or 50,000 years here.
By the time the ice was advancing again, the Hamish withdrawal was complete, and the colonists were